The following podcast is edited from the live Voices of Montana program, Montana's original statewide radio talk show that's heard Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. The show has been airing for more than 20 years, and it wouldn't be possible without our local radio affiliates. Contact your local radio station if you'd like to hear the program live in your area, and it's currently not available. The show is also streamed live on voicesofmontana.com. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program, inviting you to contact us with comments or show ideas. The email address is studio@voicesofmontana.com. Dark money, dark narratives, dark politics. You know, campaigns that cost tens of millions of dollars are forcing maybe candidates to align with special interest groups. I mean, who can afford that kind of price tag? Possibly only certain special interest groups. And what does that mean for our politics? We're going to kind of talk about that a little bit with a Montana author and former D.C. insider. He wrote a book. Is it fact or is it fiction? We'll have to talk about that, too. And then later on, the Montana Taxpayers Association here today on Voices.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now, from the year 3000, it's Tom Schultz.
The year 3000?
Yes, the Conan O'Brien joke. Remember that? The year 3000 years ago? Oh, well, you're missing out. They used to put on the UFO hats.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I do like Conan O'Brien. Yeah. He's a funny guy. I thought you were going to say something like it's National Lard Day, or it's National Pretend to Be a Time Traveler Day, or National Take It in the Ear Day, which I didn't even know what that means. It's National Brownie Day.
You know, this is a family-friendly show.
Yeah. Thank you. So, welcome, everyone, to National Pretend to Be a Time Traveler Day. I'm Tom Schultz. Voices of Montana is from Montana for Montana. We have been that way for 22 years. That's two decades and working on three. So glad to have you joining us. We'll talk a bit later on. As I said on Monday, and we started this kind of last week, we're lining up some lobbyists, all right? And it's fair to call them lobbyists. That's what they are. Although Bob Story, who is the executive director of the Montana Taxpayers Association, he knows he's a lobbyist, but he's not going to call himself a lobbyist. He's a former Montana legislator, I should say, and been involved in fighting for and against, you know, improper tax policies. And we're going to talk about what their 2021 Montana legislative agenda is going to be. Right on the other side of January, the biennial legislature will convene. So we are getting sort of a sense here this week and maybe even into next week about what some of these groups are going to hope to accomplish, or which means sometimes killing bills in the 2021 Montana legislature. Some of that's going to be speculation. Speaking of speculation, our first guest today, you know, and let's just welcome him. Roger Fleming is a Montana-based author, former D.C. lobbyist, I can say. There's more here to pass along. He was actually born and raised in Florida and served in various positions in Washington. We'll kind of talk about that a little bit. For the past 20 years, he's been a lawyer and lobbyist in the D.C. area. But he also represented Montana State University's Distance Learning Center for many years. And his consulting firm is headquartered in Bozeman, Montana. So Montana author Roger Fleming. Roger, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Author of the book called Outsider Rules. And, you know, I just got a copy of this, and I have been reading it. I, as you know, or maybe many know in our audience, have been working in congressional politics for a number of years. So I find a lot of people in those pages there, Roger. This Outside Rules, and we're going to kind of get into some topics here that you get in. You get into a ton of them there. Is it fact? Is it fiction? Or is it sort of your way of using fiction to portray some nasty facts that we still don't know how to deal with?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all those things. I wrote, you know, my first book, Majority Rules, was about a staffer in Congress, and it talked about the majority-minority mindset, and it was a little bit fact and fiction. This is my second book, Outsider Rules. It's a novel for sure, and the characters are all fictional, but it weaves in and out of things that, you know, happened in Washington, D.C., and happened in the Montana State Legislature. Where it does that, where it gets too close to reality, I provide footnotes in the end of the book, or end notes at the end of the book that kind of spell that out. But the book is definitely fictional, yet it talks about things that are really happening in the world around us today.
Centered around the Burns Tester race in 2006. There's a lot, still a lot of interest in that race and the outcome of it. And then one that I was in politics at that time, working as a congressional staffer for Denny Rehberg. The Rehberg Tester race was another one that, that many books have been written about that spurred a lot of interest. So there's a lot of interest in this, and I find a lot of facts in here. But let's talk maybe a little bit about and you also wrote a recent op-ed for publication talking about dark money. The thing that throws me in this last election was, especially in that last quarter, one of the candidates, Steve Bullock, raked in $27 million. The previous quarter was a record at $7 million. With that kind of money, and I pondered earlier on, with that kind of money, how can a candidate run for office without being beholden to special interest groups that are the only entities that can afford that kind of price tag?
It would seem almost impossible. I checked yesterday with OpenSecrets.org online, which is an organization that tracks the money for campaigns, and I tracked and looked up Montana's race for this year, the U.S. Senate race, and they actually spent a combined total, both candidates, of over $190 million.
Wow.
That's for a state that has, you know, just about 1 million people in it. So the cost per vote there is extremely high. I think it's difficult. Most of these groups, these super PACs, are on either the right or the left of the political spectrum, and they have a lot of money. And I think when they go to a candidate and talk to them about supporting them, I think they expect to get, you know, some support from them. When you're talking about that kind of money, and you know, Bullock and Daines both raised a lot of money on their own campaigns, in their campaigns. I think it was around $40 million and $60 million. But then most of the money came from these big super PACs, and most of it came from outside of Montana. About $100 million of it did. And that's another thing I write about in the op-ed.
Yeah.
You know, is it a good thing that most of the money that was spent to elect a senator from Montana came from people and organizations outside of Montana? And most of that money comes from D.C., Texas, New York, and California.
All right. Is there any easy answer here? Is there any what quickly comes to mind?
You know, I don't know if there's an easy answer. By way of comparison, if you look at the race that Burns, you mentioned Senator Burns, got there in 2006, they raised a total and spent a total of $14 million, about 20% of which came from outside of Montana. And today, as I said, for this race, you're looking at $190 million, about 80% of which came from outside of Montana. Citizens United changed the world in 2010 when it issued the opinion in the Citizens United case and made it okay for corporations and unions to pay, you know, spend money for independent expenditures on campaigns. They can't contribute money directly to a candidate, but they're the ones who run a lot of these ads. And the more that happens, the more you get these ads that come out every 30 seconds on the radio and the TV, and people in Montana as well as other states just get, you know, bombarded with it all day long. And I think if you read the case, and I've read most of Citizens United, it's a long case. It's not bad legal logic. It, you know, it's a good decision. But the impact of it, I think, is not what was expected by the majority of the court.
Yeah, and I think that's and it's hard to turn that kind of machine around. Let's talk. Roger Fleming is with us, a Montana-based author and former D.C. lobbyist, wrote this fictional piece called Outsider Rules. There's a lot of truth in that as he looks at what is going on in politics. And we see it today, Roger, as you mentioned, the dark money. And I don't even know if dark money is a fair enough term for that. In your book, you say dark money, absolutely legal, absolutely untraceable. But it was a solution to a problem that we were experiencing as a country many years ago, right?
Right, yeah. And the court took a look at it and said, you know, and first of all, you go back, all corporations were allowed to give money to candidates through PACs. They were corporate PACs. You had to register them, and, you know, people who contributed to them and where they spent had to be registered at the FEC, Federal Election Commission, and at the House and Senate clerk's offices by lobbyists. And that's all traceable money, and that's fine. What you get to now is this dark money, which is, I mean, the reason they came up with the case was filed by Citizens United is because corporations were being locked out. Unions and corporations could not give money directly to candidates. And the idea was, is this freedom of speech? Shouldn't the freedom of speech clause apply to corporations and corporations private proprietors that have been considered to be citizens? So that's part of the court's logic. And, you know, it made sense in a way. I think it does make sense. Why can't a corporation contribute directly or get involved in campaigns? But again, the impact of it, I don't think anybody had any idea at the time in 2010 that this kind of money be ramped up to the point it is today. That's the problem. And I don't, if you say, how do you fix it? It's probably got to be legislative. But the members of Congress really want to fix this if they're the ones getting elected through, you know, the process.
Right. And that's what I examine or at least talk about frequently. If we have a problem like one that comes up frequently is the Endangered Species Act and the Equal Access to Justice Act of being abused, the law as it was intended is not applied that way nowadays. So it's being abused. Is there a will? Is there a will in Congress to change that? I don't think there is. Where does that will come from? I know you don't have all the answers, Roger. And this is sort of the fun about being able to write, I suppose, a fictional story that, you know, crosses through and above and around many facts.
Yeah, and I present the questions in the book. I don't present the answers because the answers are hard and probably hard to come by. But the book talks about two lobbyists as they go through their careers earlier in the 90s and then later in 2006. In the early 90s, they have all the corporate credit cards and they're having a ball, taking everybody out for drinking and eating and golfing and skiing. And in 2006, they're trying to hang on to their careers through the reelection of this fictional senator. And it sort of highlights how much lobbyists do become dependent on certain members of Congress. They are their horses in the Senate or the House, and they need them to get reelected. And it's interesting how contingent their success becomes on the success of certain members of Congress, and that the book spells that out. But it also shows how in 2006 the Democrats ran on what they call the culture of corruption, and they used Jack Abramoff, and they hurt Conrad Burns a lot when he was running for reelection with the Jack Abramoff analogy in comparison. And they said when if they won Congress, they were going to, you know, change the law, and they did. They came up with a new ethics law in 2007 that made it basically illegal for a lobbyist, a registered lobbyist, to buy anything of value for a member of Congress or a staffer. And that changed D.C. in a lot of ways from a day-to-day perspective. But the money for campaigns has kind of gone the opposite way. While lobbyists have been reined in a little bit, the campaign money, the finance for campaigns has gone sort of on steroids.
I had to, as you mentioned, your two characters, Nick is the main one, but these lobbyists, I had to laugh a little bit because having worked in congressional politics, I was in Montana. I was like in D.C. for, you know, 2 days out of my 10-year career there early on. And then, I just thought it was funny. I just opened up the book to kind of start reading, and it's not long. Right in that first page, I found something that I thought we should examine a little bit. Old drinking buddies. And there's more to this to look at, but I just thought that was fun because it's a high-pressure atmosphere for a lot of those lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and they take it out, late at night, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, before 2007, when they changed the law, there was a lot of pressure. There was pressure on lobbyists. It was part of the game was to take members and staff to dinner. The Capitol Grill was a popular place, or Rumors became a popular place. That was Abramoff's place. Everybody went out all the time. They went golfing. They went fishing. They went hunting. And it was, you know, skiing. It was all paid for with corporate money. And that's kind of what you did. It's part of what you did as a lobbyist. You know, in the book, it talks about the backslapping lobbyist or the legislative strategy lobbyist. I think you have to be a little bit of both. But it was part of the game. And it has changed in some respects since 2007 because you can't just take a corporate credit card and take people out and spend $2,000 at a restaurant or a golf course like you used to be able to. They did, you know, there are ways around the money giving. Back in those days, you could take a member of Congress out for lunch, spend $300 for lunch at a nice restaurant and talk about legislation. You can't do that now as a registered lobbyist, but you can now go to a PAC-sponsored event and give a check for $3,000 and have that same conversation with a member.
We're going to come back after a break here and find out. We'll ask the question because Roger has been a lobbyist. What is lobbying like nowadays? Bob Story is going to join us a bit later on with the Montana Taxpayers Association. Find out what they'll be fighting for or fighting against in the 2021 Montana legislature. Tom Schultz back here with Roger Fleming. Voices of Montana, from Montana, for Montana. Rogers, based in Bozeman, raised in Florida, past 20 years, been a lawyer and a lobbyist in D.C. And let me give you a little bit into that. As he had worked for Congressman, that's Clay Shaw, Republican, and then he served as a minority counsel and then majority counsel to the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. You can learn a lot there. And then a political appointee of the administration of George Bush. And then also as a lobbyist himself, counsel and vice president of government relations for the U.S. Telephone Association and executive director of congressional affairs for U.S. West. And also, I think U.S. West Communications and Quest. It's a good list of work experience, Roger. And I don't doubt that that's why you come out to Montana and you grab your fishing pole and you get a chance to put a lot of that behind you. What is it like being a lobbyist? Why does this term lobbyist carry such a negative connotation?
Well, you know, I think it's unfair in many respects that it does. Lobbyists, I'll tell you one thing as a telecom lobbyist, I think what lobbyists do who have substantive knowledge is what's helpful to members of Congress is they go up to the Hill and we're able to talk about our industry and the complicated parts of our industry. And our job is to make it simple as we can, you know, take an hour-long conversation and reduce it to 5 or 10 minutes. And I think that's helpful to members of Congress and their staff who are trying to grapple with these issues to go to the floor. That's the positive side. The negative side is, you know, the interaction, frankly, that's required of a lobbyist to get to know members and staff sometimes looks, you know, like it's beyond, you know, not above the board. But today it's less so than it was before 2007. I mean, I can go and have lunch with a lot of a senator or their staffer, but they have to buy their own lunch. And that's the way it didn't used to be that way when you had corporate credit cards. I can write a PAC check now for on behalf of a client for $1,000 or $2,000 and go to a small breakfast or lunch and talk about the issues. But it's all up in the open and the campaign pays for the lunch. You know, I don't. But I think, you know, advocacy, whether you're a lawyer or a lobbyist, can get a bad rap depending on who you represent and how you do it, regardless of the particular dynamic.
And I guess for me, it's that association with all that money. We kind of talked about it. You wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. Not the New York Times. I think you just wrote it, and it was I'm reading this one out of the Hill. This was about a year ago that talks about the Citizen United decision. You know, as much as we kind of ponder about and bandy about all this money in politics, I know that it serves a purpose. But as in your book, Outside of Rules, in the end notes, you talk about the in Montana election spending. Maybe I should just pull it up here. I think I got it noted. Let's go here. Yeah, it was in 2006, $14 million, and 25% of that came from outside PACs. And then in the 2012 Senate race, which I was a part of, $47 million spent, $25 million, 50% from outside of Montana. And then in 2018, that number went to $73 million, at least 70% of that outside of Montana. That trend, I don't think, can continue, right? So do we have to come up with some solutions here?
Yeah, I think you do. I think it's a disservice to your average citizen who wants to be involved in political campaigns and make a difference. You know, I used to be able to get together with some of my colleagues who represent similarly situated companies in D.C. Or out west, broadband, small competitive broadband companies, and do a fundraiser for a member for maybe raise $5,000 or $10,000, and it was meaningful. Today, we just heard the figures of, you know, the race out here this year, $190 million. It seems like why bother to raise $10,000 if these guys are going to spend $190 million? I think it makes your average citizen feel less important to the process. And that those are all changes to the campaign finance laws that Citizens United decision made. And earlier campaign law, you know, statutory law was intended to try to trace that money. The money's untraceable now, not because super PACs don't have to divulge their donors. They do, and a lot of people don't understand that. What happens is 501c4s, the nonprofits, and the LLCs that give money to those super PACs, the millions and millions of dollars, they don't have to divulge their specific donors. They have to report to the IRS how much they gave and how much they raised, but not the names of their donors. And that's why it's called untraceable money, dark money.
Yeah. Absolutely legal, absolutely untraceable, as you say here. There's a, I'm looking at page 115, and thank you for pointing this out to me. I didn't have time to read the whole book, but I do appreciate it. I think I will get to it. My book reading list does not get any smaller. I don't know why. Page 115, how destructive the internet can be. I think as we see what we're witnessing from big tech nowadays, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the movie. I haven't seen it yet, Social Dilemma. But a lot of people who were involved in the burgeoning of the internet have questioned the ethics behind it, questioned what it is they were doing, or maybe how ignorant they were as to what might come of this. And you picked up on that. And so I want to kind of have you talk about how destructive the internet can be in politics. Got to take a short break. And there's also some other things I want to talk about here, too, that I found on page 245. As you talked about these candidates, they go through a lot of degradation because of politics, and it affects their family. I mean, I think of the Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings, which enrages me to this day, as a matter of fact. So we'll come on back and ponder these things here with Roger Fleming, a Montana-based author and former D.C. lobbyist. After these headlines, Brian Bennett is standing by. Reminder here that Billings welcomes our neighbors from Libby to Sydney, Sheridan to Cheyenne, all across the Voices of Montana Listening Network. Visit Billings to explore or do business. See the safety guidelines, though, at visitbillings.com/COVID-19. Visit Billings. Open for you. Here's headlines with Brian.
10 hospitals in more populated areas of Montana will get the first round of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine when 9,570 doses are delivered as early as a week from today. Governor Steve Bullock has said the state would follow recommendations from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices about who would get the vaccine first. Montana will receive more than $125 million to expand high-speed internet access across the state to more than 45,000 locations. The funds are available through the Federal Communications Commission's Rural Development Opportunity Fund, and providers will have 10 years to complete their projects. The demand for guns, bullets, and ammunition in Montana has caused a record surge in FBI firearm background checks in the state. Through the end of November, there have been 155,604 firearm background checks, which is a record, beating a 2013 record number of background checks. With Montana News headlines, I'm Brian Bennett.
I think a lot of Montanans might recognize this. I want to read a passage from the book Outsider Rules, author Roger Fleming, Montana-based, former D.C. lobbyist. At some point, all politics, lobbying in D.C., campaigning in the countryside, or fundraising anywhere in between, becomes one streaming conflict of priorities, and a river of money runs right through the middle of it. Roger, thanks again for being here. You can talk about that, the river of money. I'm curious about, you know, thoughts about how destructive the internet can be. I'm curious as to how we get qualified candidates who, they don't have to be perfect. In my book, they don't have to be perfect. But I tell you what, they got to have a thick skin, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned that passage on 115 of the book. That's, I mentioned YouTube then because 2006, the fictional character in the book, the Senate candidate Clarence Waters, he runs, is running for reelection. And in 2006, he gets pounded by the internet and by YouTube. And that was one of the first years that YouTube was actually used in campaigns and so effectively. And one of the ways they did it, they had what they call a tracker, a guy who had a video camera, would follow the candidate all around all day long from the minute they step out of their house through, you know, interactions with voters on the sidewalk and whatever the candidate said that wasn't politically correct or was stupid, they would record it and send it to their editors, and they would work it up and then put it out on the internet. And, you know, members get just beat to pieces with that. I know in 2006, Conrad Burns did, and it hurt him badly. You know, the internet has, you know, there's a big discussion these days about Section 230 liability. When I was in Congress, I was on the Judiciary Committee, and I worked on the 96 Telecom Act, which the Decency Act, Communications Decency Act was a part of, and that was, that's that law, Section 230. Senator or Congressman Cox and Congressman Wyden at the time, now Senator Wyden, they worked on it. It didn't get a lot of attention, and those organizations, the big ones that you see today, didn't even exist at the time. I think AOL was the only company that was involved in lobbying on that law. You know, Google didn't even exist until I think 2000, or 1998, and that was a search engine, and Facebook didn't come around until 2004. So, you know, it was a concept about trying to tap down the liability of these companies and try to encourage them to grow. But I don't think anybody had any idea what kind of power they were going to come into as they grew larger and larger. And now, as you see the fight between President Trump and the Congress over trying to repeal Section 230 liability shield for these companies, it's going to take place this week on the Defense Authorization Bill.
A lot of things that we can close with, but I'm just going to – I've got a minute here, Roger, and I appreciate your time and you know, your interest in this, your involvement in it. I don't know that we have time to talk about how degrading it can be, this whole process, but what are your final thoughts here before we conclude?
Well, you know, I've been involved in politics since I was a young Republicans down in South Florida and the Republican Party of Broward County, and went up to Washington and worked for my congressman. I think the more people that can get involved in politics, the better it is for our democracy, people from all ages and all walks of life. And I'm a little worried that this amount of money that's coming here now with the millions, like I said, $190 million in Montana just this time around, is discouraging people and making them feel irrelevant to the process. So I hope there's a way, different ways to kind of look at this, and I hope members of Congress will continue to look at it from both the left and the right. Because one last note, as you know, the liberal organizations outspent conservative organizations this time around. So both sides need to look at it and make a decision on what to do to tap it down.
Roger Fleming from Outsider Rules, back with more.
This is Montana continues right after this.
The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 1-866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana, with Tom Schultz.
Thank you for being here. I hope your day is going well. Talked last week about this a little bit, vaccinations coming to Montana, maybe the middle of December. Not a ton in that first round, maybe 10,000 or so. There are 45,000 to 60,000 healthcare workers. They're going to be first in line, along with our long-term care facility staffers and members and patients, I can say. And they'll be in line. There's about 10,000 of them. The governor did say last week that he's hoping to have 30,000 Montanans vaccinated by the end of the year, which is quickly approaching. I say that because that kind of leaves a lot of questions open out there. We're going to try to get some answers tomorrow with Dr. Greg Holzman. I had mentioned he was going to be on the air today, but he had conflicts that come up. He's our state medical officer with the Department of Health and Human Services and very much a spokesperson when it comes to what the Bullock administration is doing regarding COVID-19 vaccinations in Montana. We'll talk about that tomorrow here on Voices. Let's welcome Bob Story. Bob Story is with the Montana Taxpayers Association. I know that he'll be flying around because he's got the annual conference upcoming here, although it's going to be pretty much a Zoom conference held virtually, which is not quite the same thing. It's not as fun, but people are getting it done here. As we're talking this week about lobbyists and what their legislative agenda might be, Bob, longtime Montanan. He had served in the legislature for Park City, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate as well. And then I think since 2013, Executive Director of the Montana Taxpayers Association. Bob, appreciate your time here. Let's just start off with what is the agenda? What are you guys looking at maybe accomplishing and by accomplishing, sometimes that means killing bad bills.
Well, thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Thank you for being here.
Generally, our annual meeting prior to any legislative session focuses on the issues that we think will be coming up in the session. So our agenda is based on that. We look at things like the governor's proposed budget, what the Montana economic outlook is, what the legislative plans are, what the governor's plans are. So we cover a wide range of topics just to kind of get people, both legislators and lobbyists and general public, better informed about what's going to happen, assuming a session goes off in January.
Right. And I think that's a pretty safe assumption, and we'll go off in some form or another. Over the years, you know, talk about the Taxpayers Association and some of the, I don't know if you want to call them epic battles, but some of the things that you guys have been able to accomplish in a legislative session?
Well, the Montana Taxpayers Association has been around for 99 years. This is our 99th annual meeting, so we've been involved in a lot of legislative policy issues, mainly regarding taxation. And in Montana, that generally revolves a lot around property tax issues that come up, around income tax issues, and then some of the minor taxation things in other areas. But by and large, most of the issues have to do with trying to hold the line on increase in taxes, trying to keep Montana's tax system competitive in both property and income tax, so we can attract businesses and people who work and live in Montana can, you know, have a good living and a good job and keep some of the money they earn. So we've been fighting those battles for a long, long time. And you know, sometimes you're successful and sometimes you're not. It just depends a lot on the goals of the executive branch and the administration and the shape of the legislature.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. There's been a lot of discussion lately about Montana's tax structure needing to change or actually changing, and then our tax collection structure needing to change surrounding that. Remember last January in an interim meeting or an off-session meeting of the legislature, that was a lot of the focus, and it has to do with a sales tax. And the discussion going that, you know, we don't, because of certain conditions, we don't have the same tax base for our natural resources, which was a big part, a big leg in keeping Montana afloat. So a lot of that pressure now has been shifted to the local taxpayers when it comes to property taxes. The discussion regarding a sales tax, where do you guys stand on that, Bob, in general?
Montana Taxpayers Association has been a long-term supporter of a consumption tax, either sales tax or other forms of that type of tax, just because it broadens the tax base. It gives people more control over how much taxes they pay. And it makes our businesses more competitive if we can use some of that revenue to reduce the other tax burdens that they bear. So, over my involvement in the process, which is going on 20-some years, 25 years now probably, you know, there have been two groups that have stood up strong for a sales tax proposal any time it came, and that's the Montana Taxpayers Association and the Montana Chamber of Commerce.
Can we enact a sales tax in this state? And I know that for me, the common sense solution would be to enact a sales tax and then rebate year-round Montana residents. Is that part of the discussion? Or, you know, what will it take for Montanans to accept a change in their tax structure?
You know, I get more pessimistic all the time that can be achieved. First of all, politically, it's just suicide about for any governor candidate, especially to get involved with the sales tax that we've seen over the last two or three election cycles. But eventually the property owners are going to revolt, and when they do, then you'll either have a big hole in the revenue stream when property taxes are eliminated or greatly reduced, or you'll have to come up with another way to pay for mainly schools, cities, and county governments, which are the primary users of that. And so in Montana, we have kind of a unique – well, maybe it's not real unique, but in Montana, the legislature could and pass a sales tax. The governor could sign it, but – the voters can petition any legislative action to the ballot for a vote. So everyone assumes that if politically you got the first two steps accomplished and had one put in place, that it would end up on the ballot and the voters would have the last say on it anyway. And so most people have proposed going down that road, proposed going to the ballot right away with that and letting the voters choose. But the problem we have also is our Constitution doesn't let you vote on double-issue ballot measures, so you can't say, would you support a sales tax if 50% of it went to reduce your property taxes, because that's two issues.
Right.
And so, you know, you'd have to have one, would you support a sales tax? Two, would you vote for reducing your property taxes? And what generally happens then is people vote for the reduction and don't vote for the replacement revenue. So it's just a difficult political thing until things get bad enough that the voters of Montana decide that, you know, it might be a good thing to explore. But there's a lot, as you said, there are ways of doing things with that revenue stream, whether you rebate it to Montanans, whether you rebate it to Montana property tax owners, where you reduce income taxes with it, lots of things you could do. You don't have to use any or all of any of it for increased spending. You can use it all for replacement revenue if you can get that accomplished.
Yeah. I want to ask you what you think of the governor's or the governor-elect, I should say, as he has talked about, Governor-elect Greg Gianforte, talked about coming in and freezing the budget and not having any increases, and then evaluating overall. I know that we look at the cost of government, it continues to rise, but that has a lot to do with our spending priorities. And so we'll come back and address that issue, as well as this legislative session upcoming here from the Montana Taxpayers Association point of view. And I should say from the Montana taxpayers point of view, because as Bob had said, they're having their 99th annual meeting. I'm so proud of a state like Montana that has had a taxpayer organization advocating for proper policies for 100 years, not much newer than the state of Montana in itself. So back with Bob Story here in just a bit. Should have practiced this, but I got this meme, and it, and I don't do impressions, but we got all kinds of taxes for us. You remember that Forrest Gump scene? We got all kinds of taxes for us. There's federal income tax, payroll tax, sales tax, estate tax, gift tax, corporate tax, inheritance tax, property tax, gasoline tax. I'm not done yet. State income tax, capital gains tax, death tax, excise tax, import tax, home improvement tax. We got to pay for necessary services. So we're talking about fair taxes across the board with our Montana Taxpayer Association Executive Director Bob Story here. Bob, thank you so much for being here. I noted that you guys are having your annual conference. It's going to be held virtually this year. Let's talk about, can people take that in?
Sure, Tom, they sure can. Being as it's a Zoom meeting this time, so you don't even have to travel to do that. We do require registration, and our registration fee is $50. And we're getting close to the deadline for registration just because of the logistics of having to work through Zoom coordinators and getting everyone the Zoom link and that type of thing. So we can take registration through the rest of today and maybe early tomorrow, but after that it's just going to be hard to get hooked up. But the best way to do that is contact our office, which the number is 406-442-2130, and talk to them, and they will tell you how to get registered. We do credit card registrations, and then you'll be able to get the Zoom link sent to you so you can hook up, because we have a pretty good program put together. We invited Governor Gianforte, but as you know, he's back in D.C. wrapping up some of his work back there, so Lieutenant Governor Juris will be there to speak for the administration. We also have a presentation from Governor Bullock's budget director, Tom Livers, who will go through the executive budget for the coming 2 years and what priorities that the Bullock administration put out there and how that budget balances up. Pat Barkey, who's the head of the Bureau of Business and Economic Research at the University of Montana, will spend some time talking about the economic outlook in Montana in 2021 and how COVID-19 has changed our economy. We have a national speaker from the Tax Foundation in D.C., Jared Walczak, who's going to speak a little bit about federal tax reform and some state issues and things like that. And then Amy Carlson, who's the legislative fiscal analyst, and her staff are going to run through the revenue picture for the state and how they see that balancing the budget. And also, they've done a lot of work on the last couple of years. As you indicated, Tom, there had been some tax studies going on since the last session over the interim, and the legislative fiscal division has developed a lot of models and programs so they can do analysis of tax issues, and they're going to talk about that a little bit. And then we wrap up with a panel of legislative leaders who just tell us a little bit about what each caucus thinks they'd like to see happen in the session, and then take some questions from the audience. So we think it'll be a pretty informative meeting. People have always enjoyed it in the past when we go through and do that, and it sets the stage pretty well for the upcoming session then.
MontanaTax.org for more information there for the annual meeting. It's coming up tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken here. Yep, December 10th. Wait, no, that's Thursday. Thursday, okay. Yeah, we got less than a minute here, and we really didn't talk about the reappraisal of commercial and residential property taxes. Any quick thoughts on that, Bob?
I think people are worried about what the values of their properties are going to go in. On the 1st of January, the department will start revaluing all the residential and commercial property and ag land. They do that every 2 years, and they're looking at some significant increases in some areas, so people are going to be worried about that and if there should be some legislative intervention there.
Yeah, I think there'll have to be. There's going to be some super significant increases in some areas there, and we don't want gentrification to take place on our watch anyway. Bob, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Be well. Have a good conference, okay?
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Story with the Montana Taxpayers Association. It's going to be Dr. Holzman on the program tomorrow. Until then, be well. We'll see you Wednesday.
You've been listening to Voices of Montana. Comments and opinions heard are those of the host or callers, and not necessarily those of this station, sponsors, or Northern News Network. Join us Monday through Friday at 9:06 for Voices of Montana.